Good afternoon, everyone. Great to have you with us, and welcome to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. Nice to see you as ever. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me. Nice to see you, too.
Well, people, you probably heard it first here on CFAX 1070. Contaminated soil can be dumped at Shawnigan Lake. The ruling from the BC Court of Appeal. The lawyer for Cobble Hill Holdings, John Alexander, was on CFAX 1070 this morning with Adam Sterling just as news broke.
Soil can start being deposited again, essentially as of today. And the regional district is going to have to come to grips with what's the impact of having essentially stopped this operation for the last year.
And that's John Alexander, lawyer for Cobble Hill Holdings. Michael Mulligan, you've been poring over this ruling. What sticks out for you?
Sure. The decision today was from the BC Court of Appeal, and it was a review of a decision originally made by a trial court judge. And like with many of these things that wind up in court, the BC Court of Appeal is not charged with and doesn't have jurisdiction to sort out issues like, is it a good idea that we dump dirty dirt up by Shawnigan Lake? Those sort of policy decisions are government ones. And in this case, the provincial government granted the mining company a permit to dump dirty dirt in the mine up in Shawnigan Lake. They got the permit in 2013, and they started doing that. According to the judgment, they're storing the contaminated soil in synthetically lined cells that are permanently encapsulated in the cavity in the quarry, and then they cover them up with clay and dirt. That's what they're doing. Now, as I said, the Court of Appeal isn't asked whether it's a good idea to create synthetically lined cells of contaminated soil and store those near a lake. That's a decision for the provincial government, and they granted them a permit to do that under the provincial legislation dealing with mines, the Mines Act. So what the court was asked to do is to sort out who has authority to decide whether you're permitted to do that. Is it the provincial government under the Mines Act, or is it the Couch and Valley Regional District under the local government's legislation? And the Court of Appeal on that analysis concluded that what was going on there is, in fact, a mine. A mine includes a quarry digging rock out. That was one of the arguments.
Oh, so that's the argument. This is how it comes under the Mines Act, is because
Correct.
It's a quarry. Doesn't matter if you want to stick toxic soil there.
Correct. The argument from the Couch and Valley Regional District was, this isn't a mine. This is something else. A quarry digging out rock isn't a mine. So the Court of Appeal is interpreting, well, what is a mine under the Mines Act? And then that would go to the issue of, well, who has power to make these decisions, the provincial government or the local municipal government? And it's sort of like the issues that arise from time to time dealing with things like cell phone towers, right? Cell phone towers and telecommunications is something the federal government has to deal with. And they can give permission for a company to put up a cell phone tower. If you ask local residents who wants a cell phone tower near your house, well, the answer is almost certain to be no thank you. But they don't have the power to decide that. So the Court of Appeal wasn't sorting out whether these encapsulated things of dirty dirt are a good idea or not. They were simply sorting out what's meant by the term mine, and if this thing is a mine, does then, first of all, the reclamation of a mine, is that part of mining activity?
How can a quarry where no mining's being done, I mean, to my knowledge, be deemed a mine?
That's an excellent question, and that was, I guess, suppose one of the things that they had to wrestle with, and the conclusion was that reclamation, which is sort of like filling in the hole you made when you dug a mine out, putting stuff back in the hole, to turn the thing back into land where trees and things can grow, the reclamation of a mine, the Court of Appeal concluded, was part of mining. Now, on the other hand, there's another activity which the company was engaged in up there, which was to build a big concrete structure that is for the purpose of treating contaminated material before putting it into these cubes or capsules and burying it. And that activity, the soil treatment facility, the Court of Appeal found that was not part of mining. Treating the material on the site to make it less contaminated before putting it in the cubes and burying it, the Court of Appeal concluded that's not mining. And because it's not mining, the local government can regulate that. Now, the Court of Appeal said this. It said, in sum, even if there it may be more operationally prudent, more energy efficient, and more environmentally sustainable to process the imported soil, that's the dirty dirt, on site to backfill the quarry, the local government jurisdiction is engaged and must authorize the operation. So the local government can stop them under their legislation from cleaning the dirt to make it less dirty on site, but they can't stop them from burying the dirty dirt in cubes to sort of fill in the hole in the quarry, because the mining company got a permit from the provincial government under the Mines Act to bring the dirty dirt in to fill in their hole. So that's what
how
it amounts to.
How could that possibly be reclamation?
Well, they dealt with that, and they concluded that, you know, putting a thing back into, I mean, the land's now zoned, I think, for forestry or something, and industry. So putting the, filling the hole back in, covering it in, filling up the cubes of dirty stuff, and putting dirt over the top of it, and clay, so that trees can grow, would be reclamation, putting it back to the state it was in before. So they're allowed to do that because the province gave them a permit to do it, and the local government can't stop them, much like the circumstance where if you get a permit to put up a cell phone tower, the local municipality can't stop that, or an airport, for example. Otherwise, you would never have any airports or cell phone towers because they're both irritating to people who live there, right? So that's the current state of affairs. So the local municipality has authority to stop the treatment of material on site, but they can't stop them from burying it to fill the hole back in that they dug, because that's part of mining, according to the Court of Appeal.
This is precedent setting for the rest of the province, is it not?
It does, in this sense, right? It helps delineate who's got authority over these things, right?
We can stick your contaminated waste, if it's a mining operation is going on, then does this say, yes, you can put contaminated waste in the ground to fill out the areas that you've gouged out to mine?
Only if you get a permit. See, originally what happened is that the mining operation got a permit from the provincial government to put clean soil in to fill up their hole.
So they're in violation of the permit?
Well, no. They originally started with the permit to put clean dirt in the hole, and then they applied in 2011, they applied to the province to be allowed to fill it up with dirty dirt. And in August of 2013, the Ministry of the Environment granted them the permit to import the dirty dirt. So they started doing that.
Wow. Let's bring Peter in. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling CFAX 1070. Hello, Peter.
My very first concern is going to be health. For example, in 10 years down the road, if this were to leak and the contaminants were to go into Lake Shawnigan, and people would get very sick, like this is down the road. Is that not taken into consideration? So I'm going to say public health and well-being would be the first concern down the road. And the second one is, does the municipality or like the Cowichan Valley, do they not have real rights over what happens?
Yeah, Peter, thanks. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, certainly that should be a concern, but it's a matter of whose problem is it? The local government, under their power to regulate the use of land, can regulate some things, like they can prevent them from setting up this treatment facility there to process the dirty dirt before it's
put
in.
But why would they want to do that? Because they're trying to stop the thing. Why would they want to stop them from... You're just giving us the goods here, though.
Well, I mean, that's just what they have authority to do. It's a matter of who the complaint should be directed to, right? The local government can't decide whether the mining operation carries on, including filling up the mine with dirty dirt. The province does. So you have to direct the concerns to the province because your local government can't do it.
And health is not a consideration here. It's considered a mining activity, right? Okay, let's bring Judy in. Hi, Judy. Thanks for calling CFAX 1070.
Hi, I'm just wondering, how dirty is this dirt and what kind of contaminants are supposed to be in it?
I don't know if that came out in the case. Michael, you've been poring over this.
Yeah, that's interesting. It would appear that they're bringing in dirt which is dirty. They're then wanting to process it in this soil treatment facility, which they describe as a rectangular asphalt-paved pad of approximately 1,800 square meters, and it's for the bioremediation of the soil. Then they want to put it into these permanently encapsulated cells and bury them. So it sounds like the dirt may be, no doubt, under the Ministry of the Environment permit that was granted in 2013 to fill the mine up or the quarry up with dirty dirt, no doubt there's going to be some requirement that it be, you know, I would expect some degree of cleanliness such that the risk would be reduced. No doubt that's why they've built this soil treatment facility, but the municipality is able to, at least legislatively, stop the treatment of the soil. The net result of that, I suppose, would be that there'd have to be a soil treatment facility somewhere else to reduce the dirtiness of the dirt before it's brought up there, put into cells, and buried.
What a hornet's nest. We're going to take a break. We're with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson here on Legally Speaking. We're going to talk about the fact that first responders on the Malahat, the terrible tragedy of a man being killed in a car accident, they faced verbal abuse. We're going to find out from Michael Mulligan whether people could be charged for that kind of behavior. Stay with us.
From the CFAX 1070 Community Cruiser, here's what's happening.
Get your tickets now for the Fall for Wildlife dinner auction on Saturday, November 12th. A special evening in which wild animal lovers and supporters come together to celebrate, find wonderful auction items, and support the life-saving work of the BCSPCA Wild Arc. Join the BC Cancer Foundation at the 10th Annual Jingle Mingle Cocktail Party and Auction on Thursday, December 1st.
Watch for the CFAX 1070 Community Cruiser from Campus Acura. CFAX 1070.
So, what do you think?
Well, the floors are in great shape, the paint is fresh. All it needs is a bit of fenestration work and it'll be perfect.
Fenestration work?
Yeah, fenestrations. Windows, doors, skylights. Everybody knows that.
Okay.
Whether you're renovating, building, or repairing, the window replacement and installation experts at Thermal King Glass guarantee your window work is done right. Have confidence in knowing you're purchasing BC-made products, many with a lifetime warranty. Visit them online or in the West Shore. Thermal King Glass, your fenestration destination.
It's time for the Fall Floor Model Clearance Event at Capital Iron's Victoria location. Big savings now on floor model sofas, chairs, ottomans, and selected wood furniture. Check out the lowest prices of the season. And shop now for the best selection and those biggest savings. And of course, their award-winning service is included with every floor model. Capital Iron. There's no store like it for great fall clearance savings.
Capital Iron.
There's no store like it.
This Saturday, your BC Lions host the Saskatchewan Roughriders in a pivotal matchup presented by Nissan. Kickoff is 4 p.m., doors open at 3. It's the final regular season home game before the Lions head into playoff territory. Come early for the Nissan tailgate party with live band, pregame food and drink specials, and more. Plus, don't miss out on a special Emicon halftime show featuring a salute to our veterans. Lions, Roughriders, be there and bring the noise. For tickets and info, visit bclions.com or call 589-ROAR. Pride lives here.
A cozy, inviting room in an all-suite hotel. Sensational seats to the Nutcracker. All at one of the most magical times of the year. That's what you get with the Nutcracker Ballet Package from the Rosedale on Robson Suite Hotel. From December 15th to 20th, become immersed not only in the magic and whimsy of the Nutcracker performed by the Go Ballet, but with the sheer comfort and accessibility of your suite at the Rosedale on Robson Suite Hotel. For reservations and information, visit rosedaleonrobson.com.
Here comes multi-Juno and CCMA award winner Dean Brody.
Yeah, come on,
Beautiful Freak Show Tour. May 30th, Royal Theater. Dean Brody with Madeline Malone. And special guest James Barker Band. Tickets go on sale Friday, November 4th at 10 a.m. at LiveNation.com and the Royal and McPherson Box Office. VIP packages available. Dean Brody in concert. Produced by Live Nation.
Parked in the pack bay? We'll get you back on track. If it's happening, it's here. CFAX 1070. You're listening to Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. A week ago today, a man was killed in an accident in the Malahat. Terrible tragedy. And first responders from Malahat Fire Rescue were verbally abused by some other motorists. Fire Rescue Chief Rob Patterson was on CFAX 1070 with Mark Brenne earlier in the week.
Across this province, we'll be looking at that.
Well, let's paraphrase what he had to say.
Yeah, odd whining public and people, you know, everybody has to get a picture of the gruesome scene. So everybody were beating them back with sticks, pretty much trying to get them away from there with cell phones, like they need that as a trophy. That's bad enough for us to have to deal with. You know, we try to concentrate on the injured and hurt people. And now we've got John and Jane Q. Public walking through the scene, and it's, you know, when is this going to be open? Can you guys move? Like, you know, we have to get on with our lives.
That was Rob Patterson, fire rescue chief in Malahat. Michael, we had people calling in when I did this story, you know, this disbelief of people berating first responders and also walking into, as Rob Patterson said, into a crime scene. What can be done when people behave like this? Is there any legal recourse?
Sure. I mean, I can think of a couple of things in terms of what the potential penalties might be for people doing it, and then something that might help reduce sort of public anger in these circumstances. In terms of the person's potential jeopardy, if you're doing something which interferes with a police investigation, you know, if they're there doing their investigation, taking photos, and you're engaged in some conduct that's obstructing a peace officer, that's a potential criminal offense. There's also an offense of, under the Motor Vehicle Act, of failing to obey police direction in terms of blocking a road or closing off a road. I'm not sure that attaches to firefighters, but it certainly attaches to a police officer who's directing traffic. If a police officer is telling you to stop and don't drive through, and you did that anyways, you'd have a potential jeopardy. It carries a $109 fine and 2 points. In terms of what might help reduce what's going on, and plainly it's totally inappropriate to be, you know, berating the call takers or yelling at the firefighter who's there doing something.
Well, is it criminal to do that before we press on? Is it criminal to verbally abuse a first responder who's attending to an accident?
If you were obstructing them doing their job, I mean, if you're yelling at, if you're doing something which prevents them from conducting their investigation, that would be an offense. So somebody's just being irritating or buffoon, you know, being a buffoon, that's not going to amount to a criminal offense unless you're actually obstructing somebody in the execution of their duty.
And who's actually going to go after people in a situation like that? If everyone is, you know, full court press trying to deal with what ended up being a fatal accident, who's going to ticket people?
Well, the police, presumably, that's what they do.
But I mean, if they're involved with directing traffic and dealing with a serious fatal crash, who's going to have the time to pull over, you know, irate drivers and ticket them?
Sure, that's no doubt about that. It strikes me, though, that there are really two stages to these things, and it's a circumstance where the police would be helped by being given some direction. I mean, at the first stage of an accident, the task is to make sure that people's health is taken care of. Ambulances have to get there. You've got to make sure the person is medically taken care of and safe. The next stage of it is doing, and this is the part that takes the most time, is doing an investigation into the accident. Once the medical assistance has been provided, the people have been removed and taken to hospital, the thing which takes most of the time is conducting the traffic investigation. You'd have specialized police there with measuring tapes and cameras and looking for bits of bumper and so on, or, you know, so forth, so that they can do an accident reconstruction report and try to figure out who's responsible for the accident, the investigation. And the investigation is sort of stage two after safety is taken care of. And in that regard, I think that part of the investigation, it may be helpful for the provincial government to provide some guidelines and direction in terms of what is expected of the police in terms of the investigative part of one of these accidents. At the moment, there is no direction provided, and what the police wind up doing is the most thorough investigation possible. And that's what takes several hours. You have to wait for the accident investigation person to come, take the measurements, and do all these things. And there is a legitimate public policy question there. If you want the most thorough investigation done, that's going to take several hours. And it may mean that, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people are waiting for that to happen. And there is a policy choice there. If you don't want to have the Malahat closed for 3 hours while people do those measurements, we can make that decision and give the police some direction to do less than the full investigation.
And that's a separate...
That's the trade-off.
Right. And that's a separate matter. And we've discussed this, yes, on the show in the past. A different story when first responders, like Fire Chief Rob Patterson and his crew, are being sworn at a fatal accident. This is not at the investigative stage. So just wanted to, yes, hit that one home. Let's bring Ron in. Hi, Ron. You're on CFAX 1070. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. In the same vein of what we've been talking about here, what you're talking about, I'm thinking, like, in Alberta, when there's a hit and run or any accident, they put a sticker on the car so that the police know that car with damage has already been investigated. That way, a hit and run, a light's missing, and the cops see it. They can pull the car over and you know, find out why the guy's got a missing headlight and there's no sticker on his car. I think it would solve a lot of problems with the hit and runs.
Thanks for that input. Want to wait into hit and runs this go round, or shall we say that for later?
Sure. I mean, there was an example of a hit and run on the island recently, I think, where the police eventually had a lookout and somebody reported the vehicle with front end damage.
Up around court.
But that isn't going to have the same implications in terms of closing the road, obviously. That's the opposite. So, I mean, the response here from people is utterly inappropriate. There's no doubt about it. But I think that can be reduced if the police can be given some guidance in terms of what's expected of them, so that they could reasonably say, look, there's been a policy decision made, and this is how we're directed to conduct these investigations. We're either directed to take as much time as it takes, or we're directed to, once medical help is provided, complete that within a certain period of time, so that the police have some guidance. And otherwise, they may feel like, look, we have to take every conceivable investigative step. And no doubt, you know, from the people involved directly in the accident, they would want every possible thing to be done. But there's a weighing to be done there. There is a decision to be made, and I think it's appropriate they be given some guidance. And that may reduce the, you know, anger of people yelling at them and calling up, 911 and screaming at the firefighters, if it's clear sort of what the policy is. I think that would be helpful to them.
To that end, Ryan writes in, unfortunate that public anger already built up from many previous delays has now been directed at first responders. However, the public anger would not exist if the police would at long last explain exactly what takes 5 hours to do.
Right. And what takes 5 hours is not the helping the person who's injured. Nobody, I think, would argue about that. But that doesn't take 5 hours. What takes 5 hours is waiting for the accident investigator to arrive and then conducting the most thorough possible accident investigation.
How do you speed that up?
Well, to speed that up, you wouldn't be able to do the most thorough possible accident investigation. You would need to take some photographs, measurements, and then what it would mean, and this is the trade-off, is that in some ambiguous cases, you wouldn't be able to prove who was at fault for it. You might not be able to prove the dangerous driving case. And that's the public trade-off. And it's a real choice to be made. But at the moment, no public policy choice has been made. So what happens is that you wait for the accident investigator, and that takes about 3 hours once they show up. So the road's closed for 5 hours. Now, if that's the decision we've made, that the Malahat will close for 5 hours so that we can do a forensic investigation of every serious accident, well, fine. But, you know, I think that at least needs to be considered so they can be given some clear instruction.
Wow, what a show. Packed a lot in. Thank you so much, and thanks for pouring over the decision on Shawinigan Lake so quickly as well. Always a pleasure having you on, Michael.
Thank you.
Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. I'm